going to start to pull together for the study session. Anywhere, Ian.
All right.
Okay. Thank you for coming. We'll ask Stephanie to do a roll call, and we'll call to order.
Tom Moore. Judy O'Connor.
Here.
Joe Omoasagie.
I saw him.
Yeah.
A sighting was made.
Elaine Palencia.
Here.
Kyle Patterson.
Here.
Julian Rappaport.
Here.
Ann Robin.
Here.
Margaret White.
Here.
Susan Fowler.
Here.
Okay. Do we have any public participation or citizen input? Just introduce yourself and who you are and where you're from.
Is it on?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Lisa Benson, Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. I just wanted to let the group know that we will be hosting on February 8th from 1 to 3 p.m. a Restorative Justice 101 training for the community. And I've left flyers. I thought I left flyers over here. So I'll have to put them back here. I thought I'd set some flyers up here.
What day? 1 to 3 on?
It's on Thursday, February 8th. 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Urbana Civic Center. And with a flyer, you can register through one of our assistants. There's an email to send. So, thanks.
Thank you. Do we have any other citizen input? Okay. Seeing none. Beyond what we've received, I'd like to request approval of the agenda.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay. All right. This is a study session, and we have three presentations. And at the end of the study session, we will have an open discussion, which one of the board members will lead. Thank you very much. So if we could start with the study session presentation by Rebecca Woodard and Lori Taylor on the justice system diversion services.
Okay. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay. Hello. I'm Rebecca Woodard. I'm the program manager for the Justice Diversion Program. I want to thank you guys for inviting us here this evening, and also thank you for giving us the opportunity to provide these valuable services in Rantoul. We started out in July of 2017 with our search for a program coordinator, and after interviewing several applicants, we selected Lori Taylor. We were impressed by her enthusiasm and her experience with direct service and crisis intervention. And so she started work with us in mid-August, and she is going to take over and explain some of the things that she's been doing.
Okay. Hello, everybody. All right, so we're going to go over a few of the bullet points that I'm going to discuss this evening. It's just an overview. We're going to start with crisis intervention. And then we're going to talk about the goals of the program for the Justice Diversion Program, how I got started, the intervention process, outcomes, some gaps, and going forward with the program. So crisis intervention, just a brief definition, is an immediate and short-term psychological care aimed at assisting individuals in a crisis situation to restore balance to their biopsychosocial functioning and to minimize the potential for long-term psychological trauma. So basically, in a nutshell, what I'm saying is that when I come into contact with a family or an individual in crisis that has had police contact, I'm coming in to minimize the potential. I want to come in and provide immediate post-crisis stabilization and hopefully restore so that we don't have that repetitiveness with them running into trouble. So my goals for the program is first a 20% decrease in percentage of the repeat crisis intervention calls or the domestic violence police contact. Gaps in services and or barriers will be identified and tracked. We want to increase the resources in Rantoul for individuals and families who've had crisis intervention with the Rantoul Police Department. and 75% of participants surveyed will be satisfied with intervention and report being informed of services that address their individual needs. So how I got started is obviously I got to know everyone at the Rantoul Police Department. Being a native of Rantoul and growing up there and graduating from there, I was able to see some old faces and reconnect with my high school and meet the school social workers. And again, you know, just getting to know the needs of the police department and where they need me at most. Developing that rapport was wonderful. Everyone there had a lot of knowledge on how to help me and assist me moving forward with the crisis calls. I also learned their individual procedures. So that way, when it comes to getting what I need, we can work together and collaborate. In October, I was offered the opportunity to go to a crisis intervention training and become certified in crisis intervention, which I've never had that ability to do in my other positions. So that was wonderful for me as I move forward in my position with the Rantoul Police. Also educating and informing them about what I do in the program itself. Of course, Chuck and Sean, who were basically there from the very beginning with me and Rebecca and understood the grant, what we were trying to do, they knew about what the goals were. But, you know, everyone else at the police department, I had the opportunity to go in on different shifts and meet with the staff and talk to them about the Justice Diversion Program and understanding that we're all working together for the benefit of helping these families in crisis in Rantoul. Rantoul is like its own little island, so you know, often, you know, they're kind of out there by themselves, and I wanted to bring some resources and be able to be of assistance to them. And then working with the social work interns has been a very fun experience as well. So the development, I developed procedures for client intake, assessment, and intervention, and follow-up. It's a four-step process, but basically after, the police have contact with a family or individual in crisis, they pass that on to me, and then I'm able to contact the family and, talk to them about what it is that they need, if they need anything. Sometimes they don't need anything. Sometimes they do. It just depends. But doing an intake briefly, a risk assessment, and then following up with them, providing some intervention to help whoever is in need. Developing data entry and tracking methods and beginning the client intervention. And then lastly, developing a survey and survey procedures, which is very instrumental in helping me learn more about what they're thinking about this program. I've talked to a lot of clients over the phone or in person, the ones that wanted to speak with me after the crisis situation, and they would say, I am so happy to hear that you all have someone there that, you know, after I've had a hard time, I had someone I can connect with and talk with. And so as we continue with the survey process and getting feedback, that's going to be very instrumental as I move forward as well. This is a lot, but these are just some agencies that I have connected with. Some of them I've worked with before in the past, which was great, so I kind of already had that rapport. Other ones were new to me. I would say reaching out to the churches in Rantoul was really fundamental. I have a meeting with a pastor next week to discuss with her. She's having a lot of issues with people that are homeless coming into the church and saying, hey, I need a room overnight because they've heard that there's funding for one night for them to get a hotel. And so she's trying to assess, is this person really chronically homeless, or are they just coming in because they want to get a hotel for the night, you know, whatever the case may be, or they couch surfing or whatever. So I'm going to sit down and work with her on a screening tool or look up some screening tools for her to help her with that. So again, just as you can see, connecting with different resources so that I know what's out there and I can help anyone in need, and I need to know those things up front, so it's really good to build that relationship with all of these resources up there. Here is some of my data over the past 6 months. Service contacts are those individuals that I've met with, and I break it down by non-treatment and treatment plan clients. So you can see that the non-treatment plan clients is obviously those clients that, you know, I didn't provide any treatment for. However, I spoke with them, you know, gave them a call, you know, asked them if they needed any help post-crisis with anything that I can assist them with and transfer them to. And then the treatment plan clients were those that I actually did go meet with on an ongoing basis. And to the right is a pie chart that I developed that just shows the different categories of crisis calls. And I was able to, and it says category and name, and that should say suicidal threat and attempt. But that was my biggest chunk of the Rantoul community that we noticed the crisis calls were heavy in, and followed up by mental illness and domestic violence. So those are my top three areas that I'm focusing on for the new year. So of those 20, as part of the non-treatment plan clients, 20% cited needing help with and were transferred to the appropriate resources. 12% of those were repeated crisis calls. I'm going to be honing in on those repeated crisis calls more and looking at that and seeing how we can try to decrease that more and more as I get in new referrals. And then a treatment plan clients, there's more than just that I linked them to, but those are just a few, you know, case management, Rosecrans, Cunningham, shelters, Courage Connections, Pavilion. 211 is the number that you can dial for help. Anyone can dial that 211 number and it'll link you to a help center. So just a bit of outcome there for you to look at. Some gaps in Rantoul. Mental health services is also my New Year plan for the Justice Diversion Program. I'm wanting to see a way to bring mental health services in the Rantoul community, because right behind that, that's the barrier, is transportation. A lot of the families will say, I had a situation, you know, the other night where, you know, they were, you know, abusing alcohol as a way to self-medicate the mental health illness aspect of their disease. And they went to, they're in and out of the hospital all the time. And they'll say, you know, okay, after everything's over and done with, or I'm released from the hospital, you know, or they don't even go to the hospital, they have transportation issues with getting back and forth. So, and there is a C-CARTS system in Rantoul. It's a bus system right now. But I have ran into some of my clients who will say that even $2 a day is a lot of money for them. They cannot afford it. So after-school program is another one. And I actually contacted the village of Rantoul and spoke with the director of the Recreation and Parks Department. And he said that this is something he's working on for the new year. He definitely can see that this is an issue with repetitive juvenile offenses, you know, then getting into trouble after school, lots of fighting, lots of, you know, issues with them just being bored. And if they're not in any kind of sport, you know, they're getting into gang activity and things of that sort. So the after school program would be really essential to the Rantoul community. And then just homeless services, where I can, you know, meet with a person, whether they, you know, as I assess if they're truly homeless, that's number one. And then once we assess that, you know, we get them linked up. But again, that's in Champaign. So if we could bring maybe some homeless services to the Rantoul area, that would be great to kind of move along the process, get them on the wait list, and then once something opens, we get them to Champaign-Urbana. So going forward, I'm going to continue my interventions. I'm going to continue to identify barriers. And then once we do that, you know, we continue with the tracking everything that's happening. I am tracking every single thing from what's working to what's not working. Satisfaction needs assessment end of this quarter. I'm in my third quarter now, so I'm continuing with that. And continuing to build collaborations with service providers based on need. It's very important for me to get to know what's out there. I attend the Human Council meeting the first Thursday of the month, so that way I can continue to see how I can assist the Rantoul community. Again, I have to bring these things back to those folks who don't know. So that's all I have for you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Great report and very succinct. I appreciate the fact that you were able to do that in about 12 minutes. Really, because we've got additional reports, but a lot of information. Questions from the board? Yes, Elaine?
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. Right at the beginning, you had a number, 20% decrease. And could you say a little bit more about that? Is that related to a time frame? Is that decrease in number of what?
It's a 20% decrease in the percentage of households that have crisis intervention or domestic violence calls. So we want to see a 20% decrease overall. So by the end of this program cycle, which would be the fourth quarter, mm-hmm. we want to be able to gather all of our data from all four quarters and see a 20% decrease in.
Am I saying that right?
Okay, in the amount of those crisis calls.
Okay, in a year. So that's in a year.
In repeat, in repetitiveness as well, crisis calls too.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Is there any way you can pull the PowerPoint back up to the pie chart. So there was, I think it was about four categories that didn't have the labels on them. But you described, I think you only described what three were. And there's four.
I'm so sorry.
I was just curious because there's some of the bigger ones, too.
I'm sorry. I don't know what happened because that was there less than 24 hours ago. Okay. So the orange area was suicidal threats or attempt. And then the what looks like it's gold next to it, that was domestic violence at 13%. And then the purple one would have been mental illness at 12%.
What about the green one?
And then the green one was, now that one I'm thinking. 1 second, I have my PowerPoint printed. 1 second. I'm sorry about that.
It's okay.
Oh, that's behavioral. So that's calls we get that are related to behaviors that are seen as aggressive or, you know, maybe a teen ran away or, you know, something behavioral in the behavioral category that outlines some behaviors that we need to address.
What is a mental health call?
A mental health call? For example, if you have a person who, let's say the police go out there and someone reports they see someone walking around the gas station and they're talking to themselves, you know, it may be more suspected something's going on. We're not diagnosing, but suspected that something is mentally needs to be addressed. That's kind of what another one could be that actually an individual does have a mental health concern. You know, the police get out there. The 15-year-old Johnny is, you know, throwing things in his room. He's very aggressive. We find out that he's, you know, has some schizophrenia, paranoia is going on. He hasn't been taking his medications. And, you know, they actually tell the police officer that. And then I come on scene and, you know, talk to mom and the son and, you know, okay, who's your therapist? Who's your psychiatrist? Get them where they need to get to. So it can either be identified or it can be suspected.
And I guess just one last, have you been in contact with the daycare programs that are in Ranch Hole?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah, daycare, yeah. I'm finding a lot of the youth, the troubled youth that I'm seeing, it seems to be between the ages of 14 to like 17. That's where I'm finding a lot of them.
So when you're referring to after-school programs, you're more thinking in the context of teenagers?
I'm sorry, one more time.
When you were talking about like the lack of after-school programs,
yes.
That's one of the contexts of like teenagers.
Yeah, okay. Yes, definitely like high school, kind of around that age, yeah. I mean, they have the youth center, but it's...
It's kind of, Chuck, did you say the youth center is middle school more or kind of...
Middle to younger, yeah, with the youth center. So we need something for the older children.
I had read where Don Moyer is going to come into Ranch Hole.
Okay.
What population is that going to involve?
I have not heard that yet, so I will definitely follow up. But the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club, I think that don't they service the junior high to high school age?
Yeah.
Okay.
Grade school.
Is it younger than I don't know?
Yeah. It's K through 12.
Oh, great. Okay. I did not know that, so I will definitely follow up about that. Thank you.
We could move on then to the next presentation, which is Rosecrans Fresh Start, Carol Bradford and Dante Lotz. Thank you so much.
Good evening. I'm Carol Bradford, and I am the clinical coordinator at Rosecrans. We were formerly Prairie Center, merged with Rosecrans as of January 1st of this year. So we're about 3 weeks in, 3 to 4 weeks in.
Hello, I'm Dante Lotz. I'm the community service liaison for the CU Fresh Start Initiative. You can also consider me an intense case manager as well. We're not going to spend a lot of time on these first couple of slides because it's pretty much an overview of what's been going on with CU Fresh Start. How did it come into existence? I know a lot of you have been following along in regards to that. Some of you might be brand new, and so if you need a copy of this PowerPoint, we will happily send it to you. Here in Champaign County, in the years of 2013 and 14, there was a notable increase with gun violence here in this area, which brought about a lot of concern for those that are living here, work here, and just overall concern as far as the safety of this community. And so a multidisciplinary team, which we refer to as MDT, was comprised. They did a lot of follow-up, seeing what was going on, trying to make things happen in regards to how can we resolve this situation. The council passed many resolutions. Law enforcement became involved and started uniting. They formed a street crime task force, which was comprised of Champaign-Urbana, U of I, as well as the Sheriff Department as well. Community became more engaged. Law enforcement became more of a part of the monthly Champaign County Coalition meetings that happened every Wednesday, second Wednesday at the Champaign Library at 3:30. And hence, we had a development of the CU Fresh Start initiative. CU Fresh Start overall is a focused gun deterrence initiative. Law enforcement attempt to identify those that are causing most of the incidents. Those that are interested in getting support, you know, we offer that for them. We'll get into that in a little bit. And also on the other end, those that are not interested in changing their lifestyle, we're sending a message of it being swift and certain consequences, not only for them, but also their associates as well that might be involved in any gangs or cliques. Excuse me. There are three main pillars to the CU Fresh Start initiative. You have community, you have law enforcement, and you also have social services. These are the three that are comprised at our MDT team. And we represent the social services pillar. And so we focus on making better life choices to provide stability and opportunity. That happens with myself, the community service liaison, and what I do is I work with and assist and the participants identifying community resources to support better decision-making among the participants. We started out with five criteria, 18 and older on probation or parole, prior felony arrest, prior gun arrest or a violent crime conviction, and also credible information of recent involvement in violent crimes. The MDT committee decided to add the sixth criteria because it became a concern with one or two of our participants that had already enrolled in CU Fresh Start, in which they had unresolved cases. And so it caused a dilemma in regards to what do we want to do with those individuals? So the sixth criteria was added a few months back so that moving forward, we will not allow individuals that have pending cases to enroll. And I'll speak on that in a little bit. What is a call-in? That's the face-to-face meeting of law enforcement representatives, community members, social service providers, and also targeted participants. And what we do is we send a very clear message against violence, provide a genuine offer to help those who wish to change their lives as well. It's a chance for these individuals to learn about police efforts, community resources available. And they are, up to this point, they're close to the public. As an attempt to protect the privacy of those involved, as well as their loved ones. Participants are identified via law enforcement. They run a list and identify throughout the community which individuals meet those now six criteria. Once they have that list, the MDT decide how many we will target for a particular call-in. And so once law enforcement have that list, there is three of us from the MDT committee that meet with law enforcement, and they present the information, including age, gender, if they're involved in a gang or clique, and also any, like, criminal history with each participant. Once law enforcement has presented that, answered any questions from us, they leave the room. The three individuals from the MDT decide who is going to be an actual call-in. Once we select those numbered packets, because we don't have names, we give them to law enforcement once they come back in. They gather those names, and they alert either probation or parole, whichever those individuals are involved in, so that we can prepare for the next step. And this is where the invitation come in place. Myself coordinate with probation and parole in regards to how will we attempt to connect with these individuals prior to the call-in. It's an opportunity for me to get to meet those individuals. It can be in a group setting. It can be individual. It all depends on the preference of probation and parole and who they can gather in the appropriate amount of time. And, again, it also, we're saying invite, but being that they're on probation or parole, it's more of a mandate. They're mandated to attend the call-in. They're not mandated to accept the services from us. Talked about some of this. So once I meet them, that's an opportunity for me to discuss with them what CU Fresh Start is, what they can expect for the call-in, and also some of the expectations while they're participating. It also gives me the opportunity that if someone, even before the call-in, want to sign up for CU Fresh Start, they can do it right then and there. And it also just gives them that buffer so they're not walking into a room being shocked. This is something all that's unique to Champaign and RCU Fresh Start. This is not something that happens across the country. This is something unique to us in regards to just trying to connect with them prior to the call-in. The message at the call-in is your persistent and serious offending has caused you to special attention. The community insists that you stop offending. If you're willing to stop, you'll get the help. If not, then there will be certain consequences for you continuing those specific behaviors that you have been. So, again, we have the call-in. We have a post-call-in in regards to trying to connect with the individuals as well as their loved ones. And, again, that's an opportunity for them to sign up right there. Or they're given my information. I have their information, and they have a certain time frame in order to contact me and let me know that they want services, which is 2 weeks, and they have 30 days from that call-in to get their assessment done as well as their case management plan. Speaking of the assessment, we use the Adults Needs and Strength Assessment to help develop for adult behavior health services to support decision-making, including level of care and service planning, so on and so forth. This is equivalent to the CANS that's used here in Illinois. This tool here is coming from out of Indiana. These are the domains that's on the assessment, and also these are the domains in which if there's a need in certain areas, these transfer to the case management plan. We try not to put more than three on a plan at any given time because we don't want it to be overwhelming. But that's where myself can help identify some of the needs from the assessment, as well as having the buy-in from the participant in regards to them being able to prioritize which of these three you feel we need to start with to help you change your life and to think differently? Up to this point, we've had two call-in events. We had one, the first one in October 2016, and the second one was March of 2017. We've had 20 individuals total invited. We had nine that came into the call-in in October. We had 11 come in March. Out of the two call-ins, the 20 individuals, 11 engaged. Nine chose not to engage. And what we mean by engaged, meaning that they completed an assessment as well as a case management plan. That's considered engaged, not just filling out forms. Of the nine who did not engage, two were resentenced to IDOC, six had pending cases, and this is as of September 30th, and unfortunately one was murdered by gunfire. Of the 11 who engaged, four were rearrested of new offenses since the call-in. One was reincarcerated for parole violation. One no longer engaged, and five continue to be engaged. Yes. And so even with the five that continue to be engaged, we've had a situation. You guys are going to find out in a new slide. We've created subcommittees to deal with any individual participants that might have reoffended while they're enrolled with CU Fresh Start. That's the review, the new case review. And so what they do is when a situation come up, that committee meet so that they can decide what's going to happen with this individual. Is it something serious that need to be addressed and therefore the services need to be discontinued, or is it something not so serious in which, you know, the services will remain in place? And so even currently we have two individuals where services have been discontinued because they have cases that are pending. Once those cases are resolved, then the decision will be made by that review committee in regards to if we attempt to reengage them, in which those time frames come back to play where they have 30 days to complete the assessment as well as the case management. Anything else?
Just if you can talk about the four, like a little bit more information. So the one that's no longer engaged, what's the reason, that type of thing.
Okay. One individual that's not engaged. We've had a couple of situations where individuals were unsuccessfully discharged because there was a lack of communication, didn't know where they were at. We did home visits, we did the calls, letters, so on and so forth, and there was no response. We had another individual that just plainly said he got irritated with certain situations. There was situation involving an appointment where he had an outburst, and he felt as though everybody was against him. And so even though I tried to assure him that wasn't the case, he decided he did not want to participate. And so at that point, again, this is volunteer, so we have to comply with their wishes. So even in that letter where he's discharged, it's like, if you need anything in the future, feel free to contact us. The doors are still open. And so here are two of the subcommittees that were created along the way and within the past few months. We have the law enforcement update. That's the opportunity for law enforcement to come in the room and inform me of anything that's going on with the participants that we're working with. One of their issues is making sure, or concerns is making sure that I'm safe at all times as I'm working with individuals. If a certain participant has been involved in something the night before, they feel as though, you know, that's something that would be beneficial to me to know about. And so that gives an opportunity to meet. That is happening currently once a month. Other areas like Peoria are meeting once a week. And so that's something that we're still a work in progress. And then we, as I mentioned before, we got the new case review committee, which was formed as well. And again, this was due to situations coming up where we didn't have an answer or a plan for, and so this was created to address that. Next step or future ideas, some of the areas that we have found out and already knew needed some attention would be the ones, some of the ones up here. So cognitive behavior therapy and mentoring support for this particular population, support and reintegration, conflict resolution training, and areas such as resources for health, employment, education, and technical skills. We have even met with, the past couple of months, we've met with different agencies and individuals in these areas to try to see if there is something CU Fresh Start can do to support what's already out there, not trying to reinvent the wheel. And so we've had meetings with First Followers. We had a meeting with RPC in regards to Illinois Employment Training Center. We met with individuals from the U of I to see if they have anything dealing with cognitive behavior therapy already in place, and if not, what we can do. So those initial conversations have taken place. Yes.
So one of the issues that we've run into is that you can provide all of the support and connection to resources that are available, but if you don't deal with the thinking errors that occur with some of the individuals we're working with, that's not going to matter. And so we realize that it's very important for these young men to also get some type of counseling treatment related to correcting those thinking errors. And we know that there are some resources out there. There's the moral reconnection therapy that we're looking into. So there, we're trying to find an evidence-based approach we know that will work with individuals that have been involved in the criminal justice system, because it's not enough to just get them a job or, you know, help them get their license or, you know, they're couch surfing so we find them a place to live, a more permanent living solution. If we don't correct some of the moral reasoning issues that are going on with them, they're going to continue to make the same mistakes, the same choices, and end up reoffending. So those are, again, after doing the pilot year and now we're into the second fiscal year, these are lessons we've learned along the way as we've dealt with some of the different issues with the individuals. As they've come to us, we've come together as a committee to talk about what are our next steps to address some of these issues.
And so along with that, a list of some of the barriers would include adequate employment, specifically for those that may have weapon charges on their record, affordable housing, mental health treatment, specifically being culturally sensitive, social skill enhancement, talking about conflict resolution, healthy relationships, critical thinking, and then you have issues that you have system issues regarding state IDs. I have an individual that I'm working with or that was with us in which there is a law out where you can max out on your state ID. And so this law came into play where you can have no more than, I think, 10 in a lifetime. And this is a highly transitional individual who, when this law came out, I think he might have been on number 9 at that point. And so this law came out, and so I've been on the phone with Springfield for hours, the probation officer. We all have tried everything, but he cannot get a state ID at this point. And so, with that being said, what if the opportunity of employment come up, but you can't even provide a ID? Something that simple, something that many of us take for granted, but this is something that's serious. So these are some of the issues that we deal with in regards to helping this population. Some successful linkages. We have had a couple that completed the plumbers and pipe fitter exams, and we're looking for more trades opportunities for those individuals. We've had linkages to school, including Park and College, Urbana Adult Ed, GED program. We've had some that completed their public service hours, attended job fairs, even though that's limited in itself as far as who will hire you, this population. Substance abuse linkages, mental health linkages. We've even referred and linked to other reentry agencies and individuals, agencies such as MDT, annual bus pass, in which City of Champaign Township has been very gracious in supporting individuals with bus passes. Also, individual that took their driver's license exam, and we're seeking to make connections with Urbana Township at this point as well.
So, with the another example of how Township helped, they will actually help provide funding if there is something that the individual has to do that's going to cost money and they don't have that money. So if they need to get an ID or take some type of exam and there's a fee associated with it, Township has actually helped us get the money the individual needed so that they could do that activity or complete that service.
Thank you for your presentation. We've got about 5 to 7 minutes for questions before we move on to the next one. Julian and then Margaret.
If I follow what you're saying, there are five people who continue to be engaged. I'm wondering if you could tell me if you notice any kind of, what's the difference between those five people who stay engaged and the other people who you've made contact with but have, for whatever reason, chosen not to be engaged? Could you say a little bit about that?
Okay. With some of the individuals, it might have been a situation where they've been involved in, you know, a new case and end up going to court for that, and there was consequences behind that. There were other individuals who, again, when you're putting individuals in a room and it has a panel of individuals here, you're sitting in front of the panel, and then there are 75-plus individuals behind you, there's a lot of pressure in regards to enrolling. And so you question the motivation, you know, with everyone in the room, it's going to be different. Some may genuinely look at this as an opportunity to do something different. Others might be like, this is something that I must do. And so when they're feeling forced, they might feel some type of way as time go on, and you'll be able to see that as far as the motivation. We have participants that have complied and have done everything they need to do in regards to CU Fresh Start. Others have not been as consistent, and all of those things are the level of commitment is always reported back to probation and parole, because most of the meetings that they're having, I'm in the meeting, we're attending, we're being honest with what they've completed, and how they're making gains or not making gains towards their case management plan. And so, again, each individual is addressed appropriately with honesty as far as their level of commitment. Yes, and another issue in adding on to that is we have different levels of support in regards to their families. One thing that we try to do in the post-call-in is wrap our arms around family members as well. Carol was able to be at the second call-in. She was very helpful in that post-call-in. We have individuals like Karen Sims and the CU Neighborhood Champions, who are a trauma-informed group, who are in that room as well. And so even during the call-in, the family members are not right there in the same room as the participants and everybody else. We don't want to put them on the spot. So to have individuals on the other side of the building where it's being streamed at is a connection in itself. I know that Carol had made a connection with a young lady that was interested in getting back in school, so on and so forth. And so it's about providing opportunities and making sure that the supports around them are solidified as well, because it's not just about that participant, it's about those that are surrounding them as well.
So earlier, one of your slides had that the call-ins, you had two call-ins originally to decide the your caseload or how many people will be involved in this. How do you decide how many, and can you increase those to increase the number?
So that's something we're looking at right now. There are plans to have two more call-ins before the end of this fiscal year. We're in the planning stages right now to do a call-in in February. We have looked at the numbers and how it's panned out, so I believe the plan from the committee that does that selection is to actually increase the overall number that they look at and the overall number that they invite. And again, keep in mind, this is just our second fiscal year, so the first fiscal year was more like a pilot, and it was just gathering that information at the end of, you know, once that fiscal year ended at the end of June, starting in July, looking back over that year and saying, okay, what are the things that we've noticed trend-wise that we need to pay attention to going forward? And one of those was that we knew, because of the population that we're trying to work with, that the numbers, that people would fall off, whether it was rearrest, I don't want to work with you anymore. We actually had one individual who decided he didn't want to work with us anymore because he'd actually accomplished everything he wanted to. He got off probation, he had a job, so on. And so with that, we know if we start out with 40 people that we invite and only, you know, 25 show up at the call-in, and maybe only 15 of those are actually going to sign up, and then out of that 15 that sign up, maybe only 10 of them are actually going to meet with Dante for the first meeting. So we know as you keep going through each layer of that process, you start losing individuals. So from my understanding, the committee that does the selection, which includes law enforcement, is looking at a bigger pool of individuals that they will take a look at and also that they will invite to the call-in. And that's just planning for that along the way we're going to lose people.
Yes. So can there, I mean, I don't know this, just I was just wondering, so can probation, can this service be utilized as part of probation, as in, say, people who have DUIs have to take a series of classes or follow a series of, well, information, a lot of classes in different areas, life skills included. So can that be utilized to increase the number of clients you serve?
So I think what you're asking is if probation and parole can be utilized to try and increase their participation and compliance. And they're actually involved from day one. So Dante actually has contact. Unfortunately, sometimes more contact with the probation and parole officers than the clients, but he goes with them to those meetings. He transports some of them to make sure they make it to those meetings. He's communicating with probation and parole almost daily on each of the young men, and then they have a formalized meeting where they get together as well. So they're very involved. In some situations, probation and parole is a help, and in other situations, it's not a help, it's a barrier. So we kind of have to evaluate that with each individual. If they see their probation or parole officer as an ally and someone who is looking out for their best interests and they have a somewhat decent relationship with them, that person may have some influence to, you know, help encourage that person to participate. But if we're not careful, again, depending on the circumstances, that could backfire.
Then I'll turn it to you. So it's very dramatic when you look at those who chose not to participate. Of those nine, they've either
been resentenced or they're reincarcerated or they're pending or they're dead, which is tragic. And of the 11 that said, I'll give it a try, you have five who are continuing. Perhaps one of them finished and said, I've done what I need to do and mm-hmm. could be considered a success at this point, and you still have five involved.
Right.
So thinking about the seriousness and the difficulty of the situations these individuals present, how would you assess your doing if you were to look at other programs that have attempted something like this? I only know about Peoria, but you're in year two. If they don't participate, they're not in a good situation. If they do participate, some drop out, some stay. What, how would you characterize the five that stay and the one that finished?
The five that stayed are very persistent. I had jotted down a note because it was what the question was from this gentleman over here in regards to the level of commitment. We have individuals that have complied to the fullest, but it's been frustrating for them when you're constantly going through the same routine of looking for jobs, when they have finally had an aha moment and are out seeking on their own as well, but every time you try to get in the door, there's that letdown. I had an individual in which I thought I had a resource, and I sent them through a factory where I told them to pause, let me do some more research, where he went on his own. I mean, he's that eager. And he went to their computer kiosk. This is not something where you can take the application home. He spent 2 hours filling out the application and giving them the proper documentation they needed. He went to the window, and they was like, hey, looks good. Can you start in the morning at 6 a.m.? He said, absolutely. By the time he got home, he got a phone call saying, we did a background. You have a weapons charge on there. We can't deal with you. Had the same story a couple of weeks ago happen to an individual at the U of I, extra help. And so it's a lot of letdown, not only for them, for myself, you know, because I'm right there with them. And it can be very challenging as you continue to try to work with the systems that are in our community to work more together and also to be able to identify not only if you're felony friendly, but will you accept those with weapon charges? Plenty of them have went through temp agencies, but that's exactly what it is. You hit that 80-day, and they lay you off. Then they call you back a month later. And so there is no stability, even with the doors that are opening. And at this point, you asked about success. It's still hard to label success, but I will tell you that in the beginning, we looked a lot to Peoria for support and guidance. Well, now I'm hearing Peoria is looking to us for that guidance because of the methods we've used and the strength-based approach that they see as effective and have altered things that they're doing right now. And so I think Champaign and CU Fresh Start is molding something unique for the rest of the community surrounding to take a look at in regards to their approach to this.
Mine's quick. My question was, is there a certain age that is more apt to follow through with your program? And is your program ongoing as long as they need services? And there's been a lot of press about CU Fresh Start in the newspapers. When you go out in the community where these young men, women are, do you get a positive response to the surrounding people? We're glad you're here. Have you sold the program?
Have I personally sold the program? No. But to answer your question, the communities that I'm in, is well received. They feel as though it's a need. They feel as though that there need to be more efforts in regards to not only this population, but, you know, that 18 to 30-ish population have a lot of needs. The individuals we're working with is barely the tip of the iceberg. We know that it's going to take not only the efforts of CU Fresh Start, but other agencies, including the Champaign Coalition and all of that, those dynamics to constantly work together. I was in a meeting just yesterday, and the question came up in regards to the recent shootings that have been happening, and it was these individuals that are possibly involved in that, would they have made this next list? And the answer was no. This is something that's random. You never know. You know, we're in a different age right now, and so those individuals would not have been on this next call-in list. And so that just lets you know that we have to continue to be proactive. It doesn't start when they're 18. It's like grade school. We just talked about Boys and Girls Club and things of that nature and the supports of the families. I have more conversation with how do we support families. That's a weekly conversation, especially on Sundays, with me and other individuals that are working with families. And they know I know those families. And so you have the conversation of how do we continue to be proactive and how do we reach them before CU Fresh Start.
And I just want to add one last thing. One of the things that we've had to do as an MDT committee is remember that the case management component is just one piece of the puzzle. And so the case management that's being provided by itself will not take care of everything. And so there has been a lot of work and a lot of meetings and conversations between law enforcement, the legal court system, community resources, about what are those pieces that are missing that we need to work on. Or they may be there, but they're weak. There are places that say they're felon friendly and they will hire felons. But when the felon goes and applies for a job, even if they get hired, as soon as the background check comes back, they're showing them the door. So we know that those are areas that still need to be worked on. And I think that's the good part about having that community coalition, because there's so many different people sitting around the table representing different parts of our community that may be able to help with some of those areas. So we've had a lot of conversations lately about we're at the table. Now, what is each person bringing to the table to help the CU Fresh Start program be successful? And that's, I think, going forward, that's kind of where we're looking at, is what can we get from the community? We all live here, work here, and we're concerned about the gun violence. How do we help so that we can help more of these young men and have more than five that are able to do what they need to do to stay successful? And really, success is waking up each day. It really is. It's just that simple. I'm alive today because I made good choices yesterday.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate it. We have another presentation that we need to move on to, and that's the United Cerebral Palsy Land of Lincoln Vocational Services. Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much.
Hello, I'm Jenny Niebergi with UCP Land of Lincoln, and I apologize I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. I've learn my lesson, so next time. Okay. Okay, good. Our program is the vocational training and support programs, and it's a program that targets individuals, adults with a mental health disability who live in Champaign County and require extended support services or vocational training to maintain employment, become job ready, or become financially stable. Our program provides employment training, job placement services, money management training, and self-advocacy skills training to adults who want to become financially secure. Just a reminder that this program was developed because we also have a similar program with the DD board, actually identical program. And what we were seeing in the last year or so was that the majority of the folks that we were serving that were getting referrals to our from DRS had a mental health diagnosis. And so they were not eligible for our DD program for our vocational training and support services. And so that's why we had asked for the decrease with our DD program and for a program to serve folks with a mental health disability. And it's an identical program. We still receive most of our referrals from Division of Rehab Services. And our projected outcomes for the program will provide extended job support services to 30 individuals with mental health disabilities. We are currently providing those services to 8. Our next outcome is UCP will provide vocational training, self-advocacy skills training to 20 individuals with mental health disabilities. We are serving 8 for that outcome. And our outcome, employment outcome, is 90% of program participants will obtain employment. And currently 63%, 5 out of 8 individuals are employed, and 2 more are expected to start the beginning of February. So while these numbers appear to be low for mid-year, you know, this was it's a new program, and while we had seen in the past a lot of folks that come through our program with mental health disabilities, and they really needed those support services, especially longer-term support services, when they were not eligible for those services through our DD program, their case was closed, and we no longer were able to serve them. And so right now we are trying to recruit new individuals to the program, but we're really trying really hard in the last month or so to reconnect with the individuals that we had served in the past. And we didn't think it would be as big as a challenge as it has, but it has been. We've got our files out and trying to contact them. But we have had 5 new intakes in the last 2-3 weeks. So I think that, again, while the numbers seem low for mid-year, 8 individuals, I think that we really expect our higher volume to start coming in the next, you know, few months. And so I want to add one of the things that has become so vital to this program has been the vocational training, self-advocacy, and the financial training component that we've added to our vocational training skills. And we have a curriculum that we use to, depending on what their needs are, and on money management and budget and learning about checking accounts and savings accounts. And it's been so wonderful for every single one of the people in the program. And so I know I put on a success story on our the sheet that I sent in, but he truly is an amazing story. I mean, and he continues to get our financial training because he's still working with trying to budget his money every month, and the income that he gets and the bills that he has, and he's looking to start his second job in February. So it's just been great for him and for all of the individuals in the program. While, like I said, the number may be low, I think it'll really, you know, jump up in the next few months. We, you know, our numbers we were serving in the past were between 20 and 30 of those folks. So I mean, I know they're out there, and it's it may be a challenge to reconnect, but we're gonna try really hard. And so I think those numbers you'll see will get higher and higher in the next month or so.
So I think we have some questions, if I
read
Julian's hand in the air.
Could you explain the difference between one and two? What's the difference between extended job support and self-advocacy skills? And also, the eight you're talking about, the same eight people?
Yes, it is the same
eight. So some, they're getting both things.
They are getting both. Now, for this, those are the same eight. They've all needed vocational training. You know, some folks that may come into the program, like the past individuals in our programs that have been in the past, may not need that vocational training or self-advocacy. And so they may just need job support, like job coaching and case management services. But the all eight that have gone through the program have received and are receiving, still currently receiving, the vocational training and financial training.
So that happens before they get the job. And then when they're on the job, they get this job support. Is that the way I should understand this?
Well, kind of both, because depending on their needs. So, like, if a person, like the young man that started, we knew he needed some vocational training to get job ready, to get job prepped. He was homeless at the time, so he needed some vocational training and to get ready to go to work. We thought pretty early on he would also need financial training too, to help him manage his money and get him on the right track to get him financially stable. So but once he started his job, and that was I think back in September, he started the coming in on a weekly basis or every other week to kind of go over his money, you know, his checking. I think he opened up a checking account in I think November or something. So He's continuing to get financial training.
So what, if I may just follow it up for a minute, what I was wondering about is, does the extended job support get you involved with the employer?
Yes. So the extended job support is once they are job placed.
And you work with the employer then as well as the person?
Yes.
Okay. That's a sort of interesting thing that I just thought might be out in the air for other people who are trying to get people jobs. You got to work with the employer.
Right. And also to develop, you know, that those natural supports on the job. And
I understand.
And Thank you. Oh, okay.
So if you don't mind, I have a question as well. The Mental Health Board also funds a program at Rosecrans for individuals who have mental illness and developmental disabilities. And I'm familiar with a number of people or families that are served by that program, and they have young adults who have not been able to get jobs. Are they getting information about UCP's program for those with mental health issues?
Well, I know one of the things that our staff is trying to do, just in the last month, is trying to reach out to those other mental health centers and facilities that have, so to recruit from them. And if they don't have employment services, then let them know and market our services, saying, hey, this is what we have, you know, because we've gone to them. With that young man, I think, you know, we went to other agencies to help him. Mm-hmm. And so I think our staff has just started within the last month going to some of the mental health. So that's,
I can give you a caseworker's name after the meeting.
All right. Thank you.
Going with my question, I was wondering, you have the pool of DD folks that you're helping, and then the mental health people, but I was wondering about the dual diagnosis people, is how that works.
I don't believe that the out of the eight that we currently have there is no one in that eight that is dual diagnosed, but mm-hmm. all of our individuals that come to us, all of our referrals go mm-hmm. through the RPC for the eligibility evaluation, mm-hmm. and then they're, you know, deemed eligible for DD or mental health, and so. Mm-hmm.
So those people would be picked up on one or the other side of
yep.
that. Okay.
Yes.
And we appreciate what you're doing, and we look forward to hearing about the second half of the year.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Great.
Is the sum of the formal study session in terms of the three reports. I have a request from Kyle Robeson to bring up another issue. And so, Kyle, can I turn this over to you? Okay.
It's Patterson.
You know, it's mental age. What can I say? It's mental. It's aging. Thank you, Kyle Patterson.
Yes, I guess that's close enough.
I'm sorry.
I will say that this was all Lynn's idea. She made me do this. No. No, actually, I was having a conversation. I think venting would be a more appropriate description with Lynn two weeks ago, and she had mentioned I think it would be important to talk about the issue of housing and homelessness. And also it's really relevant because tomorrow is going to be the Champaign County Continuum of Care's point in time count.
It's the whole country.
The whole country.
Same day.
Point in time count where for the HUD homeless count where they physically go out and locate and identify and keep the official count of homeless people in the community. I guess I'm not really going to elaborate on how it's probably not the most effective way to measure that, nor is it very accurate, but you know, it's kind of a difficult thing to measure. So the reason I want to bring up this issue is that, I work for the Cunningham Township Supervisor's Office. I'm the case manager there. I work with people who are very low income, many of them homeless. And to me, what's just very, very apparent is that we have a housing crisis. I mean, it's not just Champaign County, it is the nation, but it's something that it's unaddressed and in many ways unseen. I mean, you probably walk past a homeless person much more often than you realize because their clothes are clean and they look nice. And it's really been a kind of a hidden problem. And I think there's really a lack of awareness out there. I think anecdote, the continuum of care meeting, one of the ones I went to, there was a homeless person had died. I think it was the weekend before that. And WCIA was at the continuum of care. And they were under the impression that it was some one-time sort of big meeting to address the death of this homeless person. And the people in the media who are, you know, tasked with informing society of what's going on had no idea that this is something that meets, you know, once a month that, you know, exists in communities around the country. And I think it just kind of goes to show the lack of awareness out there. And the reason why I think it's really important to this board is because, there's a direct connection both to mental health, both as a homelessness is a result of mental health issues, and sometimes it can be a cause of exacerbating mental health issues, especially when we talk about children. I mean, we talk about, you know, children who deal with trauma because, you know, they have two parents and they have to go from household to household. Well, what about the kid who doesn't know where they're going to be sleeping that night? And a lot of times, you know, we see with the how much we invest in, you know, criminal justice, because there's this acknowledgement that there's such a direct connection between mental health and behavioral health disorders in the criminal justice system. I mean, when you go through our programs and you look at what we fund, I mean, I'd say a majority of them are either directly or indirectly involved with criminal justice. And I think that, not to say that's a bad thing or we should reprioritize, but I think that we should also really consider, housing and, you know, how this board or can maybe look at our priorities and think of how we can incorporate that concept into what we do. Because I don't believe the housing or homelessness explicitly shows up in our priorities list. No. There are good resources in the community. RPC does centralized intake, which Carrie over there works her tail off. She is certainly overworked and understaffed, but they do, you know, really good work in Salvation Army, Rosecrans. There's a lot of different resources out there, but it's still lacking. If there's one kid who's sleeping outside at night, it's lacking. And there's a lot more than that, I can assure you. Yeah, did you want to talk about the...
Well, we've been looking at a whole bunch of different articles in the last few weeks that might be helpful. The first one The very first sentence refers to the January 2015 point in time study, and then the second document refers to the January 2016 point in time study, and then the third document is our local continuum of care report on that same point in time study. But I thought this first one was maybe the most helpful of it all. It's a little bit longer than the others, but it really does talk about what they found about the relationship between homelessness and mental illness, and think that's the core that you're trying to get to. So I like, there's a whole bunch of data in here, but it's the oldest of the three documents. So the other one is an overview from SAMHSA, and it uses 2016 data. So it has some of the same points, but it's a little bit, it's a shorter read, and it also talks about some special populations other than strictly those with mental illness. It talks about veterans, LGBTA, and there's another one. Special populations. Oh, rural. People who are homeless in rural communities. So that is interesting, too. And then here's the Champaign County's work on this, and it's related to so the point in time survey just does the street count, is that right? And then it's later paired with the HMIS data and some other. So that's what you were talking about earlier today, the you know, when you're done with the checklist because someone is sheltered and still homeless, but they're not on the street. So
we have about 200 people in Champaign County that are literally on the streets. Is that what the figure 2 trend in homeless subpopulations for Champaign County says?
In 2016. Yeah.
It's the third continuum of care.
I'm sorry, what page is that you're
referring to? Well, it's this short document, the one that was just passed out.
Yeah, the continuum of care one.
And it's this graph right here. I was trying to see what the situation was in Champaign County. So they changed the definition of homelessness in 2012, and there's a dramatic drop because of the definition change, but it shows approximately 200, roughly, looking at the graph.
I think that sounds right, of what they have listed, at least.
And that's literally no place to go except for maybe an overnight shelter. We're not talking about people who are staying with family or doubling up.
The HUD definition doesn't. Now for public schools, if you're doubling up, they include
that's
that.
That's homeless, yeah.
For the HUD definition, it's a little bit more strict. And also, like me, we were kind of discussing before the meeting, I'm not certain if they count people who are in a shelter.
If I may, the top of second page, second paragraph, this year's count, this is a combination of street count, which will happen tomorrow night, but also data from the homeless management information system, which will count those that are sheltered tomorrow night. So the numbers you have here reflect both those that are in some type of sheltered facility, as well as those that are also have no shelter, that they are literally on the street. And then there is a caveat to some of the change from 2011 to 2012, that there was a change in the definition of homelessness, which is part of the reason that you see the significant drop from 2011 to 2012. It's not that fewer people were homeless. It's that the definition of homelessness that's used for the count by the Housing and Urban Development, that they changed that definition. It's possible that prior to 2012, I think that you were referring to the Regional Office of Education, that the homeless children in schools, that may have been part of the number prior to 2011, and that was not necessarily a single day number. That was a number that was over a year. But I don't want to get too deep into that, but I just wanted to point out some of the information that is in this document. And there is data for 2017. I just could not access it for the meeting. So.
No, thank you. And do you know, was there a more recent change as well to their the HUD definition, or was it 2012 when they?
I believe it was 2012. I'm going to.
So, Kyle, of course, it's disturbing to hear this, but it's also good to know that there's a continuum of care. And are they developing recommendations or options or solutions, or are you at the point of frustration from serving on the committee thinking we're just not moving forward? Tell us why you want us to know about this and what we.
As far as the continuum of care, I think Mark would probably be the expert on that because you go every month.
Yeah. I go on a regular basis as frequently as I'm able. I would say that they are working on some of the issues. The need outpaces the services in the housing that's available. And I think that's the point that Kyle is trying to get at, if I'm correct. But we have seen some things that were very positive for the community, but at the same time, some things that took us also a step back. You have the development of the emergency shelter for families. It's 8 units. It was a pilot project, and they started out as simply being short-term hotel stays over winter months, and then working with the housing authority, and sometimes the housing authority is criticized, but in this particular case, they should be commended. They made available a building to be used for the emergency family shelter. And it's there's 9 units available. One is used as a case management office, but then 8 units for families. They can stay up for 30 days, but it is emergency shelter. We also, on the 2 steps back, is the loss of the men's stepping stone shelter through Salvation Army. Salvation Army continues to operate a stepping stone program where they will house folks. But I don't know that it's as robust as the men's shelter. You also have the loss of what I know as level 1 of the Time Center. That was a PADS program. It was 40 beds that we lost in this community. But in response to those 2 changes, we have had some churches step up. And we now have an emergency shelter for men, and that was in the paper recently, 30 days or 30 beds. It's open from middle of December through the end of March, I believe, and actually Cunningham Township enabled the shelter to open early through a grant, some funding that they provided. And that shelter is a no-questions-asked facility that so long as you're not using drugs or drinking while on premises, you are allowed to stay there overnight from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. And then you also have for women what's called Austin's Place, but that also is, and that's for single women, but it is a temporary shelter just through the winter months, also running from, I think, similar time frame as the men's emergency shelter. So so those just in general is an overview of some of the resources that exist in this community related to emergency shelter. Then you get into the issue of transitional housing as people and See You at Home. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention See You at Home and the services they provide in this community. They are one of the positive developments over the last several years in terms of developing resources. They operate the drop-in center, the men's, or it's not limited to men, but the Phoenix drop-in center that is open most weekdays afternoons, but during the cold weather, they expand their hours so that the drop-in center, while the shelters are closed, the drop-in center is open, so that everybody has at least a warm place to go. So then you get into for an individual that or a family that needs supports, there are some supports that exist in the community, centralized intake, there's rent assistance programs, there's transitional housing, there are the programs that Courage Connection operates in housing related to victims of domestic violence, both the emergency shelter as well as housing. So you have a range of services, but in the continuum of care is the primary group charged with managing addressing this issue. And then there's also the Council of Service Providers to the Homeless that meets immediately after. And they've also been done a lot of leadership in terms of developing some of the emergency shelters. But there is a need that extends beyond what we have available in the community. And as the data, the articles that have been shared this evening, including the point in time data specific to Champaign County, a high percentage of those individuals do have mental health or substance use issues.
There's something I want to add. And I think one of the gaps that we do see, though, is that while we have a men's shelter and a women's shelter, and we have crisis nursery, when it comes to kids who are 6 to 17, there's no immediate place for them to go. Now, RPC operates the family emergency shelter through centralized intake, but I mean, you're talking about at least a week process. Because, you know, they have to do things, they have to do criminal background checks. You know, they have families who have to make sure people are not sex offenders, stuff like that. So it's a necessary process. But what happens in those 7 days? Now, the ROE, I've been told, will, if the child is enrolled in local schools, the regional office of education will put them up in a hotel. But I've been told the maximum stay is 3 days. So where does the child go for those remaining 4 days?
Are we trying to reach a point of?
I think Kyle wanted an open discussion, not necessarily a solution.
Okay. Well, in that case,
awareness
I'll
raising.
Enter a discussion point.
Okay.
I didn't want to distract from where we're going if we knew where we were going. I bet you know about what's called the Housing First movement in this domain, right? I mean, this is the people, you know about this?
Do you want me to go get all the articles I've copied about that? Because they're in the office.
No, not right now. I mean, it's not. I just want to sort of get this on the table, that all the kinds of human service helpful things that Mark just detailed, I think this community is pretty sensitive to providing those kinds of things, and you can always provide more. And in fact, it's an endless need, really. So there's not much controversial about it other than the limits of our resources to do it. But if we're really trying to discuss homelessness as the problem, I believe that most of the research that exists in most places now suggests that the first thing you need to do is get people in housing. and then provide the services, not the other way around, which has been the myth of the human service community, thinking that those services are what lead to getting housing. What leads to getting housing is having affordable housing and placing people in it. So if we're going to address this, honestly, we're going to need to address this as an economic housing stock issue that goes way beyond the mental health board, but perhaps we have a role to play in working with other government agents. I mean, I don't know exactly who. We have to discuss that strategy. But if we don't address that, we're just kidding ourselves, I think. So that's my comment.
I want to throw in a little anecdote to kind of add to Julian's point. So it's actually, what's today? Wednesday? I think it was Monday. Oh, and yesterday. I had, at work, I had a individual who came in. He was 20 years old. His brother was 17. They're what is referred to as unaccompanied minors. Their parents are Mexican nationals who have been deported. So they're basically here alone, and they're homeless. And when I was meeting with them, I asked the older brother, you know, what's your guys' long-term goal here and what you're hoping to achieve? And he just looked at me with the most just confused look of, you know, he had not even considered, you know, what is your – and I was like, you know, do you guys want to stay here? Are you trying to move to Mexico? Do you want to go to college? And he just – it was the last thing on his mind was what he was doing besides – sleeping that night. And so, yeah, this idea that when you're homeless, it doesn't matter if you have mental health issues, health issues, educational issues, those things, those are not a priority. There's one single priority. And just because you're working towards that doesn't mean that neglecting the other ones is not going to be just as bad as somebody who is housed neglecting those. So that's – thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah, I mean, and thinking about just the basic need of – shelter is something that, as a society, we ought to think about. At Parkland, every semester, I know as a counselor, I deal with homeless students and students who are trying to go to school and cannot, and a couch surfing, and or sleeping in their cars, or some. And sometimes some of these students are parents with children. And so there are lots of mental health issues, however, finding a place to stay, shelter. That's the basic survival need before we can even start anything else. And, I mean, thank you for bringing it up, but I mean, it's one of those things, okay. Yeah.
Kyle, in your committees, are the Champaign, Urbana, Savoy, are they at the table with you? The cities?
You heard to the continuum. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do the cities send?
Yeah.
This is a list of.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of the continuum, the city of Urbana is and city of Champaign are active. The city of Urbana actually, in addition to the commitments that the township makes, is also receives HUD funding and passes some of that HUD funding through to agencies. The continuum is responsible for submitting the application to HUD for the funds that come through a NOFA. It's an annual application process, and it supports a number of housing projects in the community. They have placed a greater emphasis on permanent housing and less emphasis on transitional housing, and I don't believe we'll even consider emergency shelter any longer. Even in Champaign County is a single county continuum, so whatever money we apply for is used within Champaign County. There are most other continuums are multi-county, and then the counties are competing with one another in terms of their ranking of their projects and what they're going to apply for. Both the cities are involved. I don't know if the Village of Rantoul is represented in the continuum, but they're also involved in some other housing work through, like, the Community Development Block Grant. And so,
so when they're looking for permanent housing, just a segregated area that they're looking for housing?
Well, it is the Champaign County Continuum of Care.
Yeah.
So they're looking to serve the entire county.
But it's not like a certain area in Champaign, Urbana, or
Section 8 housing?
Yeah, is it like that?
Oh. The projects that they have are not anywhere as extensive as what might be available through the Housing Authority. Some of the work that they do is permanent supportive housing, so they might have 5 beds that HUD funds, and then the local provider has committed to providing mental health services. So, say, for example, Rose Grants would have 5 beds funded through HUD, and then they provide the mental health supportive services. Courage Connection, they're also a recipient of HUD funds, so they make so many beds available. Let's see. Boy, those are the only ones that come to mind, and I'm not... Shelter Plus Care. Thank you, Ron. So you have Shelter Plus Care, which is basically funded shelter, and then a commitment for the care to be provided to the resident of.
So Shelter Plus Care is an iteration, like, back from Housing First. I wanted to first, I think, regarding the person who has no future, who can't talk about beyond tomorrow, that I think this community has done a really good job with trauma-informed care training and learning about trauma and why this, you know, why children in that situation may not be able to relate even to a conversation about goals. So I think we're really in a good place for that. Housing First is not a step we've ever talked about taking here because, and there are different ways to do Housing First, but for the most part, and there's lots of evidence to show this is probably the most effective kind of supportive housing, is you provide the housing and then you offer supportive services. Supportive services are not a requirement for the lease. So it's the same kind of lease any other tenant would sign. So that, you know, that changes things an awful lot. We have, as a result of this thing I did a few years ago, the Data Driven Justice Initiative, because we're committed to that. It was an Obama administration commitment, but our commitment to that gets us some goodies, and one of those is free technical assistance from the Corporation for Supportive Housing if we ever want or need that. And one of the people who works for Corporation for Supportive Housing is an expert in Housing First. He doesn't live very far away, and he would be interested in coming and talking with us, and, you know, it just hasn't been the moment. There is one 708 board in the state of Illinois doing a Housing First pilot right now, and it's not going very well. But I'm keeping an eye on that.
I just to mention that similarly, I know a person who grew up in Decatur, who is a professor in Canada and works in Housing First. He's got his name is Jeffrey Nelson. He's got a lot of written material about this, and I've spoken to him about this several times, and he said, you know, my family is from Decatur. He visits periodically, and he said he would be willing to consult about this. I just never had the moment to suggest it because it didn't seem like something we were interested in, but he's very good.
Well, I would just like to say that it's very important to be conscious of this issue. At the same time, it can't just become a mental health board issue. It's got to be a larger issue than that because we have really constrained funds. And we start to get applications next week for the current 2019 funding year. So we've set our priorities. We're kind of we don't have a lot of flexibility in terms of what we could do financially. But certainly the Mental Health Board has the power of the pulpit in some ways. And so we know that Mark's on the continuum of care. I would suggest that we bring this back for discussion once we get through our current funding cycle. It won't be winter, so it may not seem quite as compelling, but we would have time this summer to delve into it some more, have some expert advice, and maybe ensure that if we bring in someone, whether it's Professor Nelson, did you say, or the expert from what CSH, it would be important to bring other relevant parties into the room so that it really is a cross-agency initiative. And I, you know, I appreciate the fact that you've brought it to the table, Kyle Patterson. So I think it's after 7. Are there any other board announcements?
Before we get off this topic, I did want to mention we talked about the point in time survey tomorrow night. A week from Friday is See You at Home. They're doing one winter's night in downtown Champaign. It's a huge event, but as part of that event, they will also have some panel or some sessions, information sessions, and there'll be folks doing presentations. I think they start at 6 or 7 o'clock, and they run for several hours, one right after the other. But that would be an excellent resource to continue the discussion and the education on this subject.
Thank you. Do I have a movement to adjourn as we are losing our members? Okay. All right.